Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Julius Telmer. He's a filmmaker. Julius, it's great talking to you.
Thank you, Robert. It's good talking to you. Thanks for having me.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Sam Kevorkian.
Hello. Thank you for letting me co-host the show once again.
Julius, can you kind of tell us how you got into film and just kind of give us like your brief biographical info?
Yeah. I did some film in high school, I guess. I always watched movies when I was little. I didn't do much, you know, it was before the time of internet and cell phones. So there wasn't really much to do. And when your friends weren't around, you just, I watched movies. And I watched a lot of movies. And then in high school, there was a class I took just to get some easy grades. And the film seemed like an easy way to get a good grade. So I did that. And then it was the first time I tried doing a little with a camera. And I had the first feeling that ever that there was something I knew here. There was some instinct that took over. There was something that was working. There was something I was doing that I felt a passion for that I hadn't felt for anything, and I couldn't explain it. And I just knew how to do it in some weird way. And I didn't dare to pursue it. You know how we're all being told to be engineers or doctors or be a teacher or do all these, you know, very general things that we're all being told as we're kids. And I guess so. I actually went into the army as an officer in Denmark, a special program. And it wasn't until I got kicked out from that program, because I got into a fight with my superior, that they kicked me out and I didn't know what to do. And I was so down by it that I decided that I wanted to do just only what I wanted to do the most in life, and what that all the money couldn't buy, and you know, I didn't care anymore. So I decided to do film because I found this film program in Denmark called the European Film High School. And then I just, I remember I said at this moment when I applied for it and I got in, but I had also gotten into the best business program in Denmark at the best business school. And I sent with the two acceptance notices from both educations. And I asked my mom what I should do, because I didn't know. I was what, 18, 19 at the time. And she looked at me and she said, I think you know what you want to do. What do you feel you want to do? And then she left. And left me there. And then I guess I just knew what it was, and I went to this film high school. And then I just wanted to learn everything. I didn't know a director, or I didn't know what it was. So I just started to film stuff and edit stuff. And then at some point I found out that in between filming and editing, there was a position that needed to tell people what to do, where to put the camera. And so then, yeah, for about the past 13 years, I've just been making films by learning by doing documentary, editing, doing lights, shooting. I've pretty much done all things on a set, so I've just learned by doing. And then by other means, I somehow weirdly ended up on the American Film Institute, escaping a boring bachelor's party one night. And then I ended up at the AFI.
So you're currently in L.A. right now. What are some of your observations of L.A.? That's where I'm from, and my co-host too.
You're both from L.A.?
Yes.
Yes.
L.A. is a weirdly funny place, you know. You've always known about L.A. is one of those places because of movies. Everybody around the world knows about L.A. because of movies. We've all seen it. We all have an idea about what L.A. is. So from that growing up as a child and then coming here is a wildly different experience, because funnily enough, it's exactly what you've seen in the movies. But then to be here and stay here is wildly different. You don't understand the differences before you get here. That L.A. is it feels like a very lonely place in many ways. I was so struck by the amount of dogs here, that everybody has a dog, and it felt weirdly lonely like that. And then everybody commutes around. Everybody gets into the car and they drive somewhere, and they go only where they want to go. Well, where I'm from in Europe, people walk or they You know, they take the subway or they bike. So a lot of unforeseen things happen. You run into people on the street you haven't seen for years. You go to a bar, you meet somebody you know. I mean, I find that that hardly happens. I've lived in LA for now about 3.5 years. And those sort of unforeseen things don't happen so much in LA. So there's a whole different way of being together, of relating.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird thing in LA that you have antisocial extroverts, like a weird type of antisocial extrovert that you like probably don't find anywhere else. Have you noticed that, Rob?
Yeah, for sure. Oh, you're talking about, Sam, you're talking about the kind of people who thrive in L.A.?
Type of people who, the type of people who seem to thrive in L.A., who seem to be comfortable here, you know, it's kind of like they're extroverted, yet they're antisocial. It's a weird oxymoronic combination that's combines itself in a way that you get the worst parts of being an extrovert and an antisocial person simultaneously, the worst parts of a extrovert and introvert.
Yeah, it's, you see people, I mean, I see people who I've never seen in my life. I didn't know that they existed. You see people out and about that it's just, I'm daily surprised that these people exist and walk around in a good way also. I mean, LA is a place of surprises and also at the same time, but people relate to each other in a very weird here. It's usually through over politeness in the supermarket or it's through a fuck finger in the traffic. It's the same person who would be, if you bump into them in the supermarket or walking, they'd be overly polite. And the moment you're in the car, if anything happens, they will shout your head off. It's the way people relate to each other is very, very weird and very, very strange to a European here.
It's interesting what you said earlier about cinema photography, how it captures LA, because a city like San Francisco, New York, and a lot of the European cities, because they're so compact, you can film it and capture most of the city in a small area. With LA, because it's so spread out, they sort of cherry-pick these very specific locations which are iconic in film. Like one of them is the view of the Hollywood Hills looking down over the city, or maybe it's the beach. And people have these romanticized images of the film. But then once you... Yeah. I'm speaking as an LA native. Because the city is so spread out, it doesn't really capture those in-between spaces.
Yeah, that's really the feeling when you get here the first time. You get confused. Because you have no idea how spread out it is. You have no idea the vastness and like all the in between stuff, the driving it takes to go somewhere. And you're very, very right about it. And half of those spots that people know, and then there's all this stuff in between where you're like, what's that? And it sort of just is houses on rows that is endless. And these long blocks of roads. I mean, also in Europe, we don't have straight roads. Here in America, you build the grids in blocks, and in Europe, every road changes from block to block, but there's never a block. The road is windy, or goes around, or goes this way or that way. You know, it's you can't figure a city out, and the same street is never named the same thing for more than maybe half a mile, and then it's a new street. So when you come here the first time, you also realize, oh, I can kind of find my way here, because you could just sort of like the same street is for 10 miles. So it's a vastly different experience to come here and live here or just stay here than it is from the movies. And like you say, here you capture the people very much.
Your film, Oscar, it has a very kind of Southern California, Southwestern, suburbia feel to it. You were telling me you filmed that out in Santa Clarita.
Yeah. I mean, we actually just went there because it was I wanted that the texture of a place like that, and we wanted to get out of LA. LA is a very hard place actually to shoot if you don't have a lot of money, because there are so many shows and films to shoot here. They have a lot of money, and as soon as you do that in LA, you just got to pay for everything. And it means that the crews and everything just explode into this big thing, and everybody wants to be a part of it. It's very hard, actually. I found it's one of the hardest places probably on the planet to film, is in LA. Because there's so many rules, there's so many, it makes it very, very difficult. And also why you've seen so much of an industry gone to shoot in different states than in LA. It's simply too expensive. And so what you get for the money in LA is very little for the money. So we went to Santa Clarita for texture and just that sort of lower class suburban vibe. It gave us the freedom. And yeah, I like that you can point the camera anywhere, any direction that I choose to on the day. So that worked perfectly for us.
Which filmmakers in particular have influenced you?
That's a long list in particular. I mean, I don't influence by like one or two. Again, the likes of Polanski and Tarkovsky, Bresson and Kubrick and Lars von Trier, Sam Peckinpah and Gaspar Noé Cassavetes. I mean, the list goes on. Truffaut and Paul Greengrass, and yeah, it's a vast list of people you steal from, you know.
Oh, you mentioned Gaspar Noé. What do you think about his film Enter the Void?
I think, I mean, Gaspar Noé has made my favorite film of all time, El Reversible.
I haven't seen that
that's
one.
That's my absolute favorite film. I can't maybe explain you why, but it's such an original piece. Yeah, it grabs me completely every time. Enter the Void, I think, is very good film, and it's I saw it once when it came out. I haven't seen it since, but he makes films that are so different and so its own, and he tries to do something very provocative and very. He really tries to do something very, very different and new each time, and sometimes he fails. But I think Enter the Void. I remember that sitting in my body for a long time, but it was long. I remember a lot of Asian people fucking, and then an epileptic explosion from the beginning. I find the film kind of funny because it's so insane. I don't know what you thought.
Yeah, I thought it was an excellent film, but because it is long, it's in kind of real time.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't have that. I mean, he doesn't make movies with that kind of narrative movement that we're used to. I mean, he makes like a more kind of an experience, I would say, And because he does that sort of thing, he just moves in and out of these things. And he's a filmmaker who just follows his instinct and gut. He does whatever he wants. He doesn't adhere to any rules. He'll break it. He doesn't care. And the mixture of sex and violence and always red and deep and dark tones, I find it vilely visceral. He's one of the most visceral filmmakers. Yeah.
What do you think about David Lynch?
I've never been sort of... Lynch has never sort of, happened to me, I guess. Lynch is one of those guys that I've seen his movies some years ago, but I've never gotten into him yet as a filmmaker. I haven't rediscovered him yet. I know, I mean, I've seen some clips again, and I see that what he's doing is he creates something very special, but he's also... He makes these sort of pastiches. It's like I don't know what it's called in English. Maybe. What do you think of him? Because I'm struggling for words and trying to describe Lynch.
There's just I could go on like hours talking about the different factors. There's the element of surrealism, playing with people's psyche of like what's real and what's not. Then there's this whole cinematographic style where he will focus on like say one image, like a tree, and he'll just like zoom into the tree for like 30 seconds.
Mm. He endows things with meaning that
exactly.
We're not used to have a meaning. I mean, he uses the full cinematic palette of image and sound, a lot of sound he used to an image, and makes he endows, like you say, a tree with meaning or a moment that you wouldn't normally I mean, that's one of the things he's a master of. Right? He can take and make it so scary and creepy, and you don't know why.
It's kind of, I guess, how I would describe it is, it's how he portrays the world, how the character is perceiving it, their perception of reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he uses cinema to do it. He doesn't explain it to you, and that's especially one of the things I highly respect him for. Sorry, just getting a call on the other end. I highly respect him for using cinema to do these things, and not using a word. There's so much today that is being used by dialogue, stupid dialogue, and people talking, and the filmmakers, they can all just use the cinematic language of image and sound to do this. Is for me, that's a real filmmaker. That's cinema.
And I noticed you do that a lot in your films, especially with your recent film Oscar, where you there's actually very little words in Oscar. It's mostly you tell the story with the action, and it is kind of in that style that Gaspar Noé is using, where it feels as if it's in real time, but it explains this much of the story of Oscar without using words.
Right. Well, I'm glad you had that experience, and if you, I think that's what I go for. I think there is such a. I mean, for me, the cinematic language is it's rarely used anymore in films. In new films, you see, can somebody explain to you what something means without using characters having to talk or explain and talk down to the audience, but just experience it? I think that's where those are the filmmakers that I enjoy the most are the ones that can. You don't know why you know something on the screen. You don't know why you feel it, why you understand something, but you just live in the space with the characters, and somehow you understand and you know. And it's very difficult, but all the tricks are there if you look at them, if you look at these filmmakers, and it's work to do it. And I think it's today there's people are lazy. Who makes the films? And I have very little respect for that. It's just a money machine that turns out films. And I think it's about putting cameras on people, or like you say with Lynch, on that tree, and let's really look at that tree. But how do we feel about this tree? I mean, it can sound very artistic and very sort of I don't know how to say it, but if you can use the tools of the trade that we have to really go into the human experience of things. I think that's where cinema is the strongest and needs to go.
What is more important to you, the characters themselves or the narrative?
Well, I don't try to distinguish the two. I try to make them interwoven so that the audience don't feel separated between them, so they never feel, oh, now it's the plot, oh, now it's the characters that's driving it. I try to interwove it so it's an organic relationship, so that you feel that the characters driving the narrative, but not the narrative that drive the characters. And then I think you forget the machinery. You don't feel the machinery of the filmmaking or the storytelling. And I think the best stories do that. I don't think about what's the story and what's the character. I'm just following the film, following the story and the character. I'm never conscious about which one is doing what.
What themes in particular interest you?
Well, I'm very interested in masculinity and human communication, and often lack thereof, and, you know, how we suppress our desires, and we all go around telling ourselves that all these urges we have are not real or not true, and we all have them, you know. We all have these desires we run around with. I don't know what we're so afraid of, but we are. And I mean, for me, it's about I think humans are animals, and we've forgotten that. We somehow believe ourselves that we're something else or different or more than just animals. And I really think that leads to a lot of, I think it leads to people not being able to be happy I think we have all these urges and impulses, and our instincts are, you know, from millions of years ago. And the society we've created that today has very little to do with that. And our communication is very limited, and we don't live. We used to live in tribes, and so for me, we're a very violent creature, but we try to tell ourselves that we're not. And so that's, I'm very interested in the human impulses and the denial we all run around and live in, and how we don't know how to control our emotions have related to that.
I want to ask how in modern cinema there's this trend where like they're suppressing masculinity in male characters in general, maybe.
Yeah. I could agree to that. What do you think?
Yeah, so like, can you comment on that?
I mean, I think in LA, I mean, around the world, I mean, but you have to remember, I come from one of the most feminist progressive countries in the world. I come from Denmark and Scandinavia, and there women are, well, you can say closer, we are the most equal that I think. I mean, we have the most gender equality, I think, you can have around the world. I mean, but it is a thing that has, remember that it's only 100 years ago that women had a voting right. And Denmark was one of the first places in the world, if not the first. And what I experienced there is women very much are showing that they have equal right, and they should have in any sense and every sense. And I think in Denmark they have now, but you also actually see how they're actually taking over everything. They're taking over all the best educations. They're taking over the better jobs. And they're having kids at the same time. They make better money than the men. And that has, I mean, of course, that has been coming for so long. I mean, maybe it's the joke that the men knew all along the women were better, and therefore they kept them, you know, kept them suppressed or down and in order for them not to find out themselves. And now you come to LA and you realize, I've realized that, you come here, and I mean, I've just spent 2 years at the AFI institution, and it's a very political institution. And everything is related to how, I mean, women have been suppressed for so many years, and men have become confused about what is a real man. And all of this relates to this whole nature we come from, which we no longer adhere to. We live a society that has so little to do with the nature we come from. And I found that it's gotten so confused for everybody. And of course, there should be a full equality between men and women. So there's been a surge where women need to feel that they have full equality, and women are strong in their own, and they have their identity in their own right, which they definitely should have. But it's been so fast. I mean, like the curve of this coming has been on the way for so long, but now it's just been this sort of unnatural explosion of interest and focus on this subject. So it's come in a sort of unnatural way where it feels very forced to me right now. And not that I don't think that the full equality should be there, but I just think it's like a little too forced right now. And it's like, it's just a good thing now if there's, you know, if it's representation by minority, or if it's just when I apply for festivals, I have to fill out, you know, it matters if I'm, as a director, if I am of ethnicity, minority, or that I'm a woman. I mean, simply, if I was not a white man, I would have easier time getting to certain festivals or getting funding from many places.
This is both in Europe and America.
Well, I think in Europe, we have a more natural sense of it. So it's not as forceful and strong, but that's because we've had a more natural growth of equality in Europe, whereas that has been still suppressed in America, and it hasn't had that natural, you know, where it comes to a natural state of natural equality. So we don't have that forceful, politicized debate around as much as it is here. And because it's been, we've had a curve that started much longer ago, we don't have to push things so much. And it's always there, and we discuss it, and we all want it to be there. But here it's like, it's a little too, I don't know, do you know what I mean? It's like taking a leap. it's having a hard time finding its place. So we're doing all these very, extra pushes to do it. Right? Like, I don't know how to say it. Maybe you guys know what I mean.
Yeah,
I know what you're talking
about. Yes, I know what you're talking about. It's like, it just seems like everything happens in America, like abortion, for example, gay marriage, all of these policies happen. They're not decided by popular vote. They're decided through court cases because the Supreme Court in the United States of America effectively, like, has the ability to change the law at whim.
Okay.
So things happen a lot faster in America, and, like, most of the time when liberals and progressives pass their policies, they circumvent the whole democratic process and do it through the court system.
Okay. Doesn't sound very democratic. No.
Yeah, it's not.
What are your thoughts on the different film styles of American cinema versus Danish cinema? Are there some key factors that Danish cinema is known for? Obviously, the most famous director is Lars von Trier.
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, I think everybody around the world love American cinema because you have such a strong storytelling. I mean, the narrative drive in stories. I mean, it's driven from the, Joseph Campbell and Christian Bogler's hero's journey, and that has been collected from thousands of years of, thousands and thousands of years of religious texts and mythology, and that lives in all of us because that's basically the core of what is the human experience and how do human beings learn, and that has been where mainly American cinema comes from. But if you remember back and you look at American cinema over the past, well, since we began, about, what is that, 110 years ago here in Los Angeles and New York, it's so many foreigners, if you actually look at that. When everybody says American cinema, remember who a lot of the filmmakers were. A lot of them came from Europe or from other places around the world. So American cinema has also been inhabited by the immigrants who came. And I think the strong sense of storytelling has always been a big factor that I've been influenced by in America. You just mentioned Chinatown. Well, classic American film, but it was made by a Polish immigrant, but I think in Europe, the whole practicality around filmmaking is with so much less money and less sense of the strong, clear character narrative. I mean, you say in America, you say, it's the single point, subjective, one character forward narrative, and for me, I mean, I believe in Europe we have much less money to do anything, so everything becomes almost like a handheld camera and very few characters, so it becomes much more existential than a big spectacle. And in America, it becomes the sort of extroverted spectacle, whereas in Europe or other cinema around the world, it becomes about an existential crisis of the human. We don't have so much money, so we have to just put the camera on the people. We can't do many great things like that. And so the American cinema has often been much more of a escapist kind of cinema. And in other parts of the world, again, Europe, that's where I'm from. And in Danish cinema, we ask the great questions about what is humans and who are we? What do we do? For me, the 70s were the big decade. I mean, late 60s, the 70s were the big decade of film in American cinema. It had that blend of, cinema could be anything it wanted to be. And it didn't adhere to any rules. It would break them. And that wouldn't be like today. There's, the movie is a misogynist, or this movie is sexist, or this movie needs to have a strong female here, or it needs to have a minority over here, and all this stuff sort of adheres to all these sort of political rules now. And if you look at the 70s, it's like if I write a movie that has a racist character or a character that is a demeaning to women, it's sort of the script or the story is judged upon that. And I'm like, that's the character, right? Oh, you have a sexist bad guy? Yeah, that's those people exist. Therefore, we deal with them in art and in films. And art must never become a something you judge politically.
I just want to comment that, like, continuing on that, is that, like, sometimes when, like, there's a case, this is kind of on the same topic related, how, like, sometimes the leftists in Hollywood, like the writers, producers, directors, they write a very misogynistic, racist character. Like, the best example of this is Archie Bunker. Like, they meant to portray him as a racist, misogynistic, sexist imbecile that, like, they meant to have portray him as sort of like their intention was to use him as an object of ridicule, but he turned out to be a very popular character, actually. So it ended up backfiring on them.
That's true. One thing I was gonna was interesting about your comment on the 70s in cinema is there's two different factors that made that era unique. I think with censorship, today we have censorship from political correctness, and then prior to that, in the 1950s and even into the 60s, there was a lot of censorship about you couldn't swear in film or you couldn't portray a sex scene or violence. So there's more censorship in a socially conservative direction. I think there was this one very limited, narrow, limited kind of era in the 70s when it existed in this in between those two forms of censorship, and there was a lot more freedom in cinema.
Yeah, I mean I do also say that, in censorship you can say what I think censorship in that sense can sort of be better than here. What we have now is the sort of forced political correctness. And you say about people who can't control their own emotions, they have to control other people's behavior. I think that's so true about that, and the experience of living here in America is that people try to tell you what you can and can't do. We don't have that in Europe. And I do think that what you're saying about the censorship, and censorship can sometimes be very interesting. You know how Hitchcock would use the censors, and in the end of North by Northwest, you have what's his name? The two main actors in the train, main characters, and they lie down on a bed kissing, and the movie ends, and then he cuts to a train going into a tunnel. I
Oh,
mean,
yeah.
it can't get more. So he found a way, but it becomes so laden and funny like that because he makes it obvious that the censorship had an effect on his choices, but he creatively gets around it so we all still know what it is he's talking about. I think censorship can work because it makes us all creative. It gives us limitations. Restrictions and limitations is great for cinema. I just think that the 70s films had balls, and I mean that not in the masculine just sense, but just had heart. It had soul. It dared to do things. We didn't know what was going to happen. It was not going to necessarily be a happy ending. It could suddenly turn brutal. Those films were movies in their own right, adhering to nothing, I find. And I think that cinema has never been better than then. Think about how many great movies were made in the 70s, and 80s and 90s don't even come close to this.
In both your films, Oscar and Dead End, you end with a sense of mystery, and the, both of those films deal with there is some kind of a conflict which leads to an act of violence, but you keep the audience in suspense, asking questions rather than explaining to them the exact ending of how the story will end.
Yeah, I mean, you have to. I think you have to have mystery in films. I think people are too. Today, people are too. They want sugar, They don't want the salt and sorry. They think sugar is good. That then they just want to be told everything. They want all the answers. And I don't think human beings work that way. I think in deep down, it's about the questions and not about the answers. And I think we want those questions. I think we kid ourselves by thinking we want the answers, and we don't really want them. We want the mystery so that the story can evoke something inside of us. I mean, the whatever film you make, you know, you watch it and it only becomes alive the moment that somebody watches it and asks questions in themselves and they feel something. And they only live in the space of the mystery. As soon as you know, it's like Polanski, he says, if you end with happy ending, they will just, you know, lick their fingers and be like, what's for dessert? You know, they will forget about your movie instantly. If you break them, if you leave them wanting more, and you only do that by leaving with a mystery or something broken, a tragedy, the film will stay with them. And it's like, we all had that, you know, for the two of you, we all have that person that, you know, the first big love we had, somebody broke our heart when we were teenagers. And we'll always remember that because that hurt sat in us and it still sits in us. We remember that person, that first love that broke our heart. And I think that's what a movie can do. And that's why I love going into that tragic direction. For me, tragedies have been always more interesting stories. I mean, the Greek tragedies. And I think, again, I think we're violent as human beings. And that necessarily meant that I like violence. I'm very attracted to it in cinema, but I detest violence in reality, of course, but I think we have it in us. I mean, that's why we watch movies. We play computer games. We're attracted to watching all this sports with violence in it. We have it in us, but it doesn't mean we have to and want to go out and exercise it upon each other. I just think there's a space there that is important to get into, but yeah.
Can you talk about your documentary, The Man Who Couldn't Die?
Sure. Yeah, he's a friend of mine that he's an ex addict, and I met him, and he started to tell. He said to me, the last time I died, and I was like, what? Just say that again. The last time I died. I'd never heard that sentence ever spoken or nothing like it. That has so much in that sentence. The last time, that mean that happened, but you're here. And the last time, meaning it wasn't the first time you died. I think he's overdosed a lot of times and been brought back. We just thought that it would be interesting to make this little piece about him and let him tell his story a few times about what happened and why. Did he end up there? What happened to him when he was a kid? He had some traumatic experiences. And then we just put him in a room like a confession. And I wanted to see that. He's a very masculine guy. At the same time, has this brutal sensitivity about him. And that lends itself very well to film or to visuals. So we just shot this little thing and... Yeah, I don't know what you think about it, but what are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, I think the story itself was very powerful, but it's also interesting how you combine the story with your choices of close-ups. Like, you have a close-up of his watch, and then there's also the dramatic effects of the darks and the lights, the dark body over the sunlit room. Can you comment on your choices in cinema photography?
Yeah, I mean, you could say that I would very much, I shot him like, I thought of him, his body as a landscape. So I tried to shoot him as a landscape, where I wanted the camera to be in there, where it's sort of everything on the human body looked different than just, it's not just an arm, you know, it's a mountain ridge. It's not just an eye. So I wanted to get in so close because the story he was telling was so brutally honest and personal that I think the images would lend themselves to reflect that. And I think also that each image you shoot should be a painting in itself. And so we shot it like that. And we shot a lot of it with 120 frames a second. So it's almost like you took a photograph of somebody, but the photograph is alive because it's kind of moving.
Yeah, I've noticed in... this documentary and your other films, there's a lot of focuses, up closes of the facial expressions of the characters, and you really capture their emotions.
Yeah. For me, there's a lot of 70s cinema in what I do, I guess, or and especially in this little, documentary about him. it's very stark and naked. But I also thought it was an exercise to show you can shoot a man in a white room, and we use no lights. I mean, it's just me and a camera and my cinematographer. That's it.
Oh, so you're saying it was all natural lighting.
It was all natural, yeah. I like to use restrictions in that sense and be, it's about the positioning of camera and the use of how you position a person or something, an object you shoot in relation to light. It's not about putting up a lot of lights. It's just about using the light you have there and then finding out how do I between the light source, the object I'm shooting, a person or whatever it is, and then the positioning of camera. And I think then I just shoot with my gut and go for what's interesting. We may make, you know, you make a plan, but you go out and you say, it's not working. We have to search for that thing that is rubbing us, that something is alive. We have to find something in the image that's alive. And then he brought the idea of black and white. It wasn't even my idea. It was Strasbourg's idea. He said it should be black and white, and I just knew he was right.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Do you have any upcoming film projects you want to talk about?
I'm currently writing the feature based on Oscar. So I'm writing that, and I'll be taking that around town. I would love to do that within the next year, and also within the actor Daniel, who's the main character, the lead, is still young enough to play the part. And then I just shot another. I just did another short film called Thieves, about a thief that goes around stealing, and I'm editing that right now. Where we follow him for a day, and he goes around stealing, and then he sees another thief stealing from a pregnant woman, and he that's where he sort of draws the line, and by a look, he just sort of like shakes his head at the other thief who sees him looking and says, you're not stealing from her. And that leads to a conflict. Then I have another few things that I'll be working on trying to make, but that's about it for now. Yeah.
Julius Telmer, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And also, thanks, Sam Kevorkian.